Hi, welcome back to Cambridge Inside Out. I'm Judy Nathans.
And I'm Robert Winters.
And we're still here. And
we are still,
here. In our little Zoom bubbles, but I love it. Our Zoom rooms.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
It We've been doing works. This since April of 2020, right?
Yeah.
I think that's when CCTV kind of got back on the track with trying to get stuff.
Yeah, done. I remember we would, when we started doing that, it was kind of weird at first, but I at least had a head start because I had been already thrown into the Zoomy world because of the classes.
Well, true,
because
of your classes. And I
got to see the math books behind me.
That's right. No, and I actually, I've done webinars, but I really never did Zoom. So I just did all the, what do you do and have an arm's length and don't have the light coming right down. And so I've learned a lot. And boy, when I watch Zoom stuff, I said, oh, what are they thinking? They get up from the chair, they're eating, they've got shadows on their face. I'm thinking, some respect,
I was having a nice conversation with a person, a recently retired person who taught in the Medford schools. He had a bit of a Cambridge connection as well. Well, it was actually at a Hanukkah gathering. I was at the other day. Yes. And it was very interesting because, we were making observations about how we were all thrown into this Zoomy kind of world. School administrators, including Harvard University, where I am, they didn't have all the answers.
No.
So all of us were essentially inventing this, this whole new medium. We were all like early TV pioneers, So we were looking at like really crummy cameras and really crummy microphones and bad lighting and whatever. Yeah. I mean, Harvard University was very generous in helping get me set up.
Me get set up, and I think I look pretty good.
But the thing is that there were public school teachers from high school level all the way down to elementary school who are now having to completely reinvent the whole art of teaching.
Plus, they had to have a good connection.
They needed
depending
good
on where you lived and the kids. I am awe inspired. If anything else, I think that this pandemic that's probably one positive thing, even though people might complain, is that our ability to do this.
Yeah.
And thank you to Zoom, which I guess I don't know what their stock is worth, but anyway.
To whatever degree any elementary school teacher in particular was able to somehow provide not only education, but engagement and enthusiasm to their very young students. I mean, I'm just astonished that people could even do that. And that is a heavy lift.
Well, I think they had a heart. Yeah, a lot of them had a heart.
But I think in many places, it was not school administrations or support staff or anything they were doing. People were just discovering things on their own and inventing things and sharing information and techniques and things that worked and didn't work and whatever. It was there's a story that you have to be told.
And I'm sure someone will, is over. Because I think it got much better after the summer, because they were thrown into it in the spring.
Yeah.
And so I think that was a mishmash. But then by September, although a lot of kids were back in school in September in a lot of communities.
And
in fact, our younger kids were there. They had a hybrid thing going on. I don't know.
Oftentimes people forget the fact that how adaptable young people can be, too. So when you first threw people into this, sure, some of them actually didn't come back, and there was a lot of truancy and whatever.
A lot of kids went to private schools or they went to Catholic schools because they were open. Yeah.
But many of the students actually are the ones who then became very adept at working in Zoom and submitting assignments and doing it online. Yeah.
But you have to counter that with also how depressed some kids. I mean, I know
that's absolutely true. And
that's true across the country because they've been doing studies. So this is
It's absolutely true.
I mean, there is a lot of depression from all of us, as you said, from being at home. Maybe being in a family situation that isn't great. Maybe your connection wasn't great. It was bad.
Right.
So school is really a refuge for a lot of people.
Right. But let's not discount the fact that many people have risen to the occasion too and actually
made
the best of a bad situation.
But isn't that true of human nature anyway?
I think it is. Yeah.
Are more resilient.
I guess I mainly see it through the eyes of the students who come to my classes too.
That's self-selective. You can't really.
Very much. Oh yeah, absolutely true. Absolutely true.
All right. How did we get off on that? Wait a minute. Oh, okay. But anyway,
we were talking a little bit about this discussion, if you want to call it that, at last night's city council meeting on
campaign
finance, which is really we're kind of nearing the culmination of, you know, I could just say it's like 6 years of discussion of this, you know, initiated by Councillor Carlone and others.
Nadine.
Yeah, and it's been certainly in the last couple of years, it's been sort of high. And I think what they were proposing is basically a limitation on anyone who was seeking to gain some, financial gain.
Anyone that has business before the city. Anybody. Right. It doesn't just have to be real estate. It could be, I guess, anything.
How do you determine that? A $200 per year cap on how much money such a person should actually donate.
Right.
You know, and
but then they're affiliates. I mean, that's the whole crazy.
Well, you know, there's a difficulty in defining, you know, who fits into these categories.
I know.
And it also creates an opportunity for a lot of sort of rhetorical shenanigans too. So for example, somebody brought up, I say, okay, so if somebody wants to basically get some change in zoning that's going to allow them to build 20 stories as opposed to 10 stories, and then that gives them the ability to gain a lot of more, their asset becomes a tremendously more valuable. So for them, you know, dropping $1,000 to every counselor would be considered a very, very cheap investment, right? You know, like there seems to be an implication that somehow there would be a quid pro quo. I personally, right. I'm not quite sold on that truth just yet.
It's crazy.
But then there's also people try and flip it the other way. You know, there are some sort of known people who are, you know, I think it was really the treasurer and president of the ABC group, for example, were the ones who were basically arguing, well, every time a property owner, a homeowner contributes money to a counselor who is opposed to increased density, then they are increasing the value of their single family home.
I thought they made some good arguments, and also Mark McGovern's thing about downzoning and stuff too.
Yeah. Well, I'll just sort of point out though that completely perpendicular to all of this is those property values have been skyrocketing regardless of anybody giving money to anybody.
Well, someone said that too.
Yeah. I found that the argument to be kind of tangential.
No, but I think the point was, I like the point, I think Mark McGovern brought that, you know, this applies to upzoning, but what about people want to downzone?
Or just a curb cut, for example, if the ability to provide on-site parking on your property might increase the value of the property. So therefore, if anybody is seeking a curb cut from the city, should they then be subject to this? Yeah.
Well, who's going to research all this? You're going to have whistleblowers. You're going to have, like I said, it's going to be like Texas. You got to say, who helped this person get there?
Yeah, this person's actually the cousin of a person who lives on this street who's doing this on behalf of so
and
so.
And you're going to have start people looking at people's portfolios that, you know, some of these people that spoke. I mean, come on, they were coming from certain neighborhoods and certain income levels. And God forbid we should have to, you know, as they sit in their nice, cushy houses with probably lots of money behind them and give $1,000. Give me a break. That's crazy.
But what I will say to that is simply this, is that there is income inequality and differences in wealth are part of the landscape in which we live. Yeah. And it has always been that way. And it will always be that way.
So money talks.
And money has always talked. And it will
no matter who's giving it.
Exactly. And I also say that, you know, those who are crying poor, there are some candidates who do not come from wealthy backgrounds,
right,
who manage to pull in some pretty good, hefty contributions too. Yeah. So it's not purely a matter of what zip code you're coming from.
No, not the candidate, but I just don't think the amount of money that we're talking about is that tremendous now. I mean, maybe you said later, but
we'll talk a little bit about independent expenditure PACs in a moment, but my personal point of view is that if we're talking about the current state limit is used to be $500 cap per year. Now it's $1,000 per year. I wish they kept it at five.
State set, So the state sets that.
Yeah, okay. There's a limit on campaign finance. So you can't contribute more than that. Of course, if there are several members of a household, you'll see husband and wife each contributing, because now the cap is 1,000. So you know, Mr. So-and-so puts in 1,000 and Mrs. So-and-so puts in 1,000. So it's effectively a $2,000 limit for the family or something. And there were some people who were property investors back in Kendall Square years ago, where you would see that like every cousin and brother and sister and wife and spouse or whatever was putting in $500 in those days when that was the limit. And so they effectively got many, many times the
It's like bundled limit. Well, those are like bundled contributions.
Yeah. So, you know, those of us who track this stuff, we have to kind of know who the players are to be able to sort of say, okay, I know this much, you know, so you can really see what is true. But my personal point of view about this is that I'm actually not in favor of the kinds of limitations that are being proposed right before the council. Not that I don't appreciate controls on campaign spending and campaign finance.
We both it's just said that,
From my point of view, if you actually look at the way this has played out, is that the amount of contributions from real estate developers, whatever, is actually less these days than it was in years past.
Right.
So the message has already gotten through that this is not necessarily in your best interest if as a candidate to be known as the guy who's pocketing lots of money from those groups,
right?
There are some candidates who do take a lot of money from some of those sources. I mean,
still,
I
wonder. It's not 90% of their
contribution. Oh, it's no.
It's like maybe 20%, if that, or 10%.
It can be 20 and 30%. Yeah, 30%? It can be as high as that.
You know, I didn't see it that way, but
So there are a couple of counselors who pulled in a lot of money that way. And then there are others who actually gain politically by their refusal to take that money.
Right.
Because it depends on which voters care and which ones you want to appeal to. So if you're Dennis Carlone, for example, and he's not the only one, you refuse to take money from those sources and you are rewarded by doing so.
Yes.
Right. Now, my personal point of view about this is that you know, trying to come up with some convoluted ordinance that restricts this is not nearly as valuable as simply very, very loud, clear public disclosure. I've done my best just to sort of highlight how much money people are taking in, what the sources are, to whatever degree I can discern it. And if people want to judge people based on that, let them do it. You know, some of the candidates I voted for took money from developers and some of them took none. So it doesn't affect me.
It doesn't affect me. And you know what? You brought this up, or I saw it on the list, somebody responding to your list about unions and real estate and how come you're against you? You know, and I'm thinking, well, you know, real estate developers, union people work for construction companies.
I mean,
so how do you separate that out? It's like, unions are okay, but real, no, you don't. But I'm saying other people, they have this mindset that it's somehow different. And one I think you know who I'm talking
about. My primary reason for including unions in there is that I've been around for a while and I've watched when there was a major, like a zoning petition in Kendall Square or whatever, or somebody wanted
all
a special
the workers
permit,
came out. Yeah.
They would basically ring them all up and then they would, they would bring in the union guys to actually step up to
especially
the microphone.
Especially if they lived in Cambridge.
Because
they
to them, this is a big development meant jobs for, you know, guys in the carpenters union or whatever, right?
What about the teachers union? You know, there you have, that's another union. I mean,
that's
I'm just saying,
that's right.
It's just,
but my primary reason for highlighting it is that it has a lot to do with the extraordinary advantages that incumbents have in elections. Mm-hmm. So the thing is you do not see large amounts of those dollars flowing toward anyone other than incumbents.
That's right.
And I, that's what I don't like, you know, so to me, you know, if reelecting incumbents is reason why a lot of that money is coming in because it's a sure vote, you know, or, you know,
people vote for who they know. They're not going to vote for someone that maybe they think they can get. I mean, I don't know.
Right.
They look at their track record.
But to me, it still comes down to just disclosure. And I think the Office of Campaign Political Finance and other entities have done a great job at helping sort of take away the veil of secrecy about campaign finance. And people just, if this matters to them, they should look. Yeah. And some of us will help provide it, you know, help you look. And if you don't care, then don't look and don't worry about it, you know? I think a lot of people who are voting for some candidates, they don't care. They, you know, in fact, I've even heard one candidate, and I won't name the names here, but who actually argued, look, if I can get $10,000 real fast from a few sources here, that alleviates me from all the pain in the butt of having to sort of beg money from everybody else. So to me, it's worth it because it enables me to do what I want to do much better. You know, so as long as there's some clarity that they're not sort of acting in any corrupt way by getting the money from that source, then to me, it's sort of, what's the problem? I don't really see it as a problem. You know, another thing too, which is sort of something I have had to struggle with over the years with whenever I sort of help put some of the information out, is that I know for a fact that there are some candidates who are getting money from developers who they went to grade school with, who they were lifelong friends with. And how am I supposed to discern what the intention of the donor was? You know, I mean, I'll put it out. If somebody's clearly listed as a real estate developer, all right, I'll include it. But I don't feel great about that because, you know, if I don't, but it's not, I don't want to make that judgment, but that's a hard one for me.
I just find it just such, I don't know, listening to some of these people, I think,
What I don't like is it's sort of when it turns into sort of a battle of righteousness, you know?
The morality of it all. Oh, God forbid I use gas in my home. God forbid I drive a car. God forbid I eat meat. I watch television. I mean, give me a break. I was in Arlington the other day meeting with someone who I mentioned something and she watched what I watched. And I said, it was like so refreshing. I'm going to move to another community where I don't feel like some, you know, parasite.
Tremendous amount of, you know, some people call it virtue signaling. But it's really sort of like, you know, just spreading your virtue around. Look at me. I don't drive. When I bought a Christmas tree, I made sure I pulled it back on the back of my bike. Aren't I wonderful?
I know.
You know, and then I took it home and I cooked up my pumpkin pie on my induction stove. Wonderful?
Are you not referring to a recent tweet from one of our former
Maybe I am.
About bit, the yeah. wreaths and everything.
In the I know. It's like,
I saw
you know,
her the other day.
Like if you want to, you know, if you want to be righteous, but I don't need to hear about it, honestly.
If you admit you even, you know,
makes me want to go out and eat a big greasy hamburger
I know
and wash it down from a beer that hires scab labor while I'm at it, right?
It's this moral high ground that some people and the yet they'll have the Black Lives Matter in their yard.
That's right, hypocrisy
of some people. I don't want to come down on all people. I mean, I'm sure they donate money to really good causes and everything. It's just that, please. The other thing, real quickly, you know, a lot of these about the policy orders, some of these people are coming new to the system. They think just because you vote yes on a policy order that it's automatic. That please vote yes. Don't they realize it has to go through a process? I really think people don't get that.
I think that's really right. But the thing is, some of the city councilors don't get that either. I mean, there are some councilors, who's no longer going to be a councilor soon, was Jeevan Sabrina Wheeler, who seemed to think that because there was a 5-4 vote from the council asking the manager to do something, then why didn't the manager just sort of jump quick and make every single thing happen? You know, fundamentally what you do is you hire a manager to manage, and then, you know, council orders are basically saying, well, these are the policy we think the manager should be carrying out, but always with the proviso that if something doesn't make sense financially or otherwise, or if there are other priorities at play here, that doesn't necessarily mean that the manager's going to jump and do it.
How does it work then with a city council that has a mayor? Is it the same? I mean,
that actually relates to some of the misconception people had about some of the ballot questions
that happened in the November election.
Right. So, for example, if you have a city like Somerville, for example,
right?
Just because it's right nearby, or the city of Boston. It has a directly elected mayor, and the mayor then serves as the chief executive officer of the city.
Right.
Then it makes total sense that the legislature could and should act as a bit of a balance against that. So that if a strong mayor wants to sort of say, well, I've decided to appoint, you know, all of my brothers and cousins to, you know, to all the important agencies of the city, that maybe the legislative branch should have a little bit of say so to say, well, sorry, Joe, you can't do that. Right. But in a city like Cambridge, where it's a city manager form of government, where the people of the city have not chosen the chief executive officer, the councilors have. And when they hire a manager, they entrust the manager
to make
with
these
managerial decision powers.
Right.
You know, and the charter, the people in the 1930s who designed the Plan E charter were not fools.
Yeah.
They kind of understood the fact that you needed
the correction that could evolve.
Once the manager was in there and basically in charge, that they felt that having city councilors being able to sort of strong arm the manager once he's been chosen was sort of problematic.
Right.
So that's why there's actually a provision in the charter that makes it a felony for councilors to be far too overt in pressuring the manager or by bypassing the manager and leaning heavily on a city department head or any other city employee. It's a felony.
There seem to be more accountability in our system. But,
yes.
But getting back to the thing about what were you saying? Shoot.
But the point is that if the city councilors had no role in the selection of the chief executive,
then
it makes some sense for them to have a little bit of a veto power or some sort of oversight role, just in case the people of the city made a real big mistake.
Right. Well, but in the city mayor, the mayor can veto things that the city council comes up with, right?
Or in a place like that, yes, I think so. Having to do with budgets and things. Yeah. You know, rules regarding budgets are one thing, but in terms of enacting policies and such, then it's a little bit different. Actually, in the city of Boston, there was a change. It was one of the less renowned changes when they elected Michelle Wu, but it was also a referendum or initiative petition that basically now gives the Boston City Council the right to
more power, right?
To basically, I think it's line item veto on some of
that's a big one.
Provisions. So, and you already saw that being tried out, even though it's, I don't know if it's in effect yet, but when Michelle Wu said, we want to just have the free tea. And that's going to cost $5 million or $8 million.
They want to increase it to three buses, not the free.
Right. So we're going to extend the free bus pilot program.
Right.
But there is a cost associated with that.
Yeah, because the money right now might be covered by the
ARPA. So immediately, some Boston City Council said, we would like to have some say so in that.
Right.
And apparently they can have some say so in that.
That's right. That makes sense.
Right. So there's a place to have some back and forth and have the legislator checking the executive and vice versa. The city manager form of government that we use here basically does invest this fair amount of authority in a manager, but the manager ultimately serves, as they say, at the pleasure of the council.
Right. But the only thing about the city manager and the system, I emailed you this, the whole list of awaiting reports is based on policy orders, right?
All right.
I don't get that. That's too much. Yeah.
Okay, so that's a big topic, actually.
I know.
It's something that appears
either
at the back of the agenda.
Either get rid of them if you're not going to do it or not.
My feeling about that is that if the city manager basically throws in, if a city council passes an order that is just ridiculous, the manager should come back the next week and say, I'm sorry, this is ridiculous. And if you want to fire me, but this is ridiculous.
Okay.
They should be passing those things off and shooting them right back rather than letting them languish.
I mean, even before Louis.
It's a long tradition of just letting them sit there and sort of die.
There's got to be a statute of limitations on this stuff, no?
They could put it in the council rules. You know, they've always had the power to change the rules to require
things. Well, they need to change that, number one. And also, the whole getting back to the ballot questions, which still annoys me. Because as I've said, I looked at the people who voted for it, 14,000 people, 4,000 to 5,000 people voted against some of them. And To me, that's not a mandate. How many people is that out of it's not a mandate. Our electorate? You know,
my issue with the
25%.
Listen, I think everybody knows I was opposed to the ballot questions and even wrote some of the opposition argument.
Yeah, right.
But one of the other things about that is that that was sprung on us all.
I know.
And there was no
any
time to even organize an educational campaign.
No, and it was all associated with what candidates were supporting it. So people, if you supported that candidate, you supported that question.
That's right, exactly. You know, so that was bad process.
Bad process. And it's going to be, you know, it's going to be interesting to see what unfolds on this and how much time is going to be spent.
You're actually, and maybe we'll spend the last minutes of mentioning this here. So the previous council meeting, there were actually, and one before that, there were actually some board appointments. And then there was some pushback with people saying, Mr. Manager, why did you do this now?
Yeah, right.
Why are you appointing members to the planning board and these other appointments
here? That's true. That was an interesting
before giving us the opportunity to have some pushback and veto some of these people here, whatever. To me, that was like a taste of what's to come, and it's going to be hard.
Yeah, that's the real biggie: the planning board, the zoning appeal, and the historical commission. I think the rest of them, they don't really care that much.
But for those who think this is somehow a great boon for democracy, the real truth is that there will be unelected people basically adjudicating who should and should not serve on the Board of Zoning Appeal, and then letting their counselors know who they should allow or not allow on the board.
I'm not looking forward to this. This is
not democracy. Yeah. This is basically backroom dealing.
We need to select a city manager. We need to select a city
clerk. Those
minor things, right? But let's just get all into the minutiae. But anyway, I'm going to stop ranting. We have a half a minute left. So we'll be meeting again on
December 21st. We'll be back here for another program.
There will be the city council.
Yeah, I will say though, just because I put together the Cambridge Civic Journal, that I've been kind of putting up a lot more things up there, having to do with elections and other matters, and what have you. So
good. Oh yeah, we didn't even get to talk about the early. We'll do that next time because we're not voting again right away. But that was an interesting roundtable. Okay.
That's right. Anyway, there's sort of plenty going on around town. So
I know.
Anyway, we'll be back
next time
soon enough on Cambridge Inside Out.
Bye.